I'm going to share an email I received recently. I've never actually done this before, but this feels like something... I don't know. I'll just read it. I love this podcast. It opens up my worldview of the world of theater and the people who inhabit that. It makes me love the complexities of storytelling just that much more at the end of each episode. By that, I mean, it shows me how vast storytelling and the storyteller who tells it can be, thus adding to the complexities of the story, and still making it all the more captivating. It has also reminded me that not every writer is the same, and this may be the most important thing. I often feel like I'm not a writer because my routine is so sporadic and I haven't sold anything and whatever the negativity is. Then I listened to the Clara Barron episode and was like, okay, I'm okay. Also, your interview style, and he puts interview style in quotes, which... Also, your interview style could easily be mistaken for just a genuine curiosity about the playwright. It's great. It's so refreshing to hear genuine conversation in a podcast. This podcast challenges, inspires, and encourages me to be a better writer. Thank you, a fellow writer, John. And that's everything I want somebody to think and feel about this podcast. Thank you, John. You are okay. It's gonna be fine. Just keep writing. Friends, welcome to the Subtext Podcast. My name is Brian James Polak, and I am the Master of Ceremonies. This month, I speak with Cord Arrington Tuttle about balancing plates, playing football, and being at home in your body. If you want to send me an email, here's the address, thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. Follow me over on the Twitters, @SubtextPodcast. I try to keep that feed relevant with playwriting opportunities and great things said by awesome playwrights and fantastic articles and announcements from American Theater Magazine. Sometimes I'll plug a production by a playwright who has appeared on the show, and I will plug the latest episodes from this podcast. All of that is to say that the Subtext Twitter feed isn't just promotional. There's some really good content there, too. All right. Cord Arrington Tuttle is a multidisciplinary artist from Charlotte, North Carolina. He is currently writing for Them Covenant on Amazon and recently wrapped writing for Mixtape on Netflix. His plays have been developed and seen at the Ojai Playwrights Conference, the Fire This Time Festival, the 24-Hour Plays, Home Based Theater Collective, the Movement Theater Company, the New School's 2015 Afrofuturism Conference, and the 10th Magazine, in collaboration with the Leslie Lohn Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art. Cord is a recipient of the Steinberg Playwriting Fellowship and was selected as a finalist for both the 2017 Alliance Candida National Graduate Playwriting Contest and City Theater National Award for Short Playwriting Contest. In 2016, his play Clarity won the 41st annual Samuel French Off-Off Broadway Festival and was published in their successive anthology. He is a current playwright in residence at Lincoln Center Theater and is a Middle Voice Theater Company member at Rattlestick Playwrights Theater. He has received his MFA in playwriting at the New School. Cord and I spoke in early February in a comfy lounge at the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
I'm feeling great today.
Why?
I am. I'm feeling great because I'm feeling forced, or rather, not forced, I'm feeling called into presence.
Yeah.
So today's first preview.
Uh-huh.
For Graveyard Shift.
Yeah.
And there have been, I mean, as is always the case, there are always factors that come to the fore that we weren't planning for.
Right.
And weren't expecting.
Yeah.
So today's actually, I guess we've been in tech for a couple of days, and first preview and first run all in the same day.
Yeah.
We have a new lead actor, one of our leading actors, has been replaced in the past couple of days.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of newness, a lot of change. Yeah. I actually also this morning moved apartments, moved residences while I'm here. So a lot of transition, yeah. A lot going on.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm now, I think in the past, in moments like these where so much is happening all at the same time, I think in the past I would allow myself to become overwhelmed by all of that.
Yeah.
And I think I've learned now, I've transitioned to a place where when everything is happening, it's actually a call for me to pause and to be here now and to be able to sort through things one thing at a time. And yeah. So in this moment, I'm really grateful to be here on this comfy chair, sharing right. space with you, doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Now with you.
How would this manifest before, when things would get challenged in your life, what would happen?
I would not allow myself to fully be where I am. So mm-hmm. I would have had, maybe a couple of texts that I'd started drafting but not sent because I wouldn't have allowed myself to be fully present in that thought. I might yeah. have had emails that I started, I would have, my script might be open on my bed where I'd started to maybe think about rewrites for later, or, all of those kinds of things. I think I would have allowed myself to be pulled in all of those directions without just yeah. choosing one thing and right. reaching completion for that one thing and allowing it then to be gone from my mind or gone from my kind of energetic space so that I can focus on the next thing
yeah.
and think about things systematically.
Right. Yeah. How did you get from there to where you are presently?
That's a good question. I really think that it was through an exercise in failure,
yeah.
an exercise in allowing all of the plates just to crash. I think I reached a point that started about, last fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about this time last year, but really, I guess last fall, really.
Mm-hmm.
September, October, November, when I was working on several projects at once and was very much in transition and was working, I was working on actually a graveyard shift at a couple of different places, developing this play, a couple of different places.
Mm-hmm.
I was also working on an opera, writing the libretto for an opera, and it also just started working in television, writing on a show. So there was a lot of travel. There was, my mind was in lots of different places,
mm-hmm.
and I was approaching my work and my life in a really unsustainable way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just reached a place where I realized, okay, despite the appearance of success,
right,
despite
yeah.
how all of this looks on paper, might be projected outward,
yeah.
I know that what I'm feeling is misery. I know that what I'm feeling doesn't feel good and doesn't feel like a good use of my gifts, my energy,
mm-hmm.
My time. And because I'm already in it, I'm going to have to do my best and stick it out, but actually just let some of these plates crash and have to learn the lessons and pick up the pieces. And so I feel like the transition towards the end of 2019 and into 2020 was one of not picking up new plates until I'd really taken time to analyze the pieces that
mm-hmm.
had already fallen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So really starting over in many regards.
I've had some conversations with playwrights in the past who, this happens with a lot of playwrights, whenever I say the word success, just know that I'm putting quotes around it,
okay.
right? But whenever success starts to come for a playwright, opportunities start to come and you know that feeling of wanting these things. So when they're coming, you're afraid to ever say no.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up taking them all on. And there's no training for this. There's no training for how you keep all the plates spinning, or whatever metaphor we want to use.
Right.
And it can be really overwhelming. I was talking to a player, and I'm a playwright who hasn't felt that. So I am that playwright that looks at you on paper and is like, holy shit, this person's got it all, right? Like, how could they possibly ever be unhappy, right, in any way? Because getting all those things obviously means you've got to be happy about it. And I was having dinner with a playwright once who, and this was astounding to me, this was maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, and this playwright was talking about 4 different commissions they had at the same time. And I was like, and it was in this feeling of being overwhelmed. And they were like, they weren't like humble bragging. They were like really worried. Like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. This is really, really hard. And at the time I'm just like, you got 4 commissions. Like, this is the most amazing thing yeah. ever. But it still brings this like level of pressure, right? That you are not prepared for. Like, nobody really talks about it. Because it's supposedly a good problem to have, right? Yeah. I'm glad that as you're going through this sort of like period of your career, you've got this self-awareness, it seems like, right? Like, my plates are falling and crashing. This is not a good feeling. If this wave comes again, how do I approach it differently, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm working on it. I think for me, what it's allowing me to do is really, really, really interrogate my intentions.
Yeah.
And also, like, just get in better touch with intuition, really.
Right.
So sometimes if there is a collaborator or an institution or a situation that doesn't feel right, like somewhere in my, like in my gut, if I have a question or I feel a kind of ping of something that is asking me to pause or to take a moment or to ask another question.
Yeah.
Like, I'm learning to honor that because I've learned that thing never goes away, actually, and often can like manifest in ways that are more harmful than helpful. And I think alongside that, I've really been asked to interrogate my relationship to scarcity.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and patience as well. I'm learning that just because an opportunity comes my way or something looks really good or flashy, doesn't mean I'm supposed to say yes.
Do you feel comfortable at this point saying no to something?
I do.
Yeah?
I do, yeah. Yeah, and it feels good. It feels good to be able to say that. Certainly was not always the case. I think part of it for me, in learning the power of no, when I hold space for the finite amount of time that I have here, and I think about purpose, I think about mission, I think about interests, I think about... my natural inclinations. I feel like for me, it's worth waiting for the thing that is going to be a home run. And like a home run doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the thing that's acclaimed, but the thing that's going to allow me to feel like I'm contributing my gifts to the world in a way that is going to allow me to be the fullest expression of myself or collaborate with some folks or tell a story that feels like I'm uniquely situated to tell or to contribute to, instead of something else, because it leaves me feeling unfulfilled. It leaves me feeling empty or sometimes at worst abused or used or manipulated. And I think for me, like, that's never worth it.
Yeah. I think, I like this perspective you have, because the nature of the thing that we do, create theater, it's by nature fleeting. Right?
Yes.
It doesn't last forever. So if we aren't being present, then what's the point of it? It'll be over before we find joy.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And I have a deep interest in ceremony and in ritual, and to me, like, sharing space with you in this moment or sharing space with a group of people in a theater or around a table, like, that's sacred. And I think in this world where we are so drawn to or sucked into our devices and the internet, and I think the internet can be an incredible tool, but I feel like my experience of the world is one of great distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it doesn't actually serve me as a maker to not invite that sense of presence into process, mm-hmm. into choices, and into the construction of a piece or the curation of an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think I just have to be there and be in it. And if I'm going to practice what I preach, that must be reflected in the things I say yes to and how they're built.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you have people in your life modeling this kind of behavior?
In a sense, yes. Yeah, my childhood was atypical than that of the folks I grew up around, or many of the folks I grew up around. So mm-hmm. I was homeschooled for 6 years. So I spent a lot of time actually at home and with my siblings. I'm one of six kids.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a lot of time playing outside, spent a lot of time storytelling, and didn't spend a lot of time actually watching television. I actually had to pay to watch TV growing up. At the beginning of the week, my parents gave us a certain number of TV tickets.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
I love this.
Like 30-minute
right.
TV tickets.
Right.
And once we used up our TV tickets, then there was no more TV. So we could like save up our TV tickets if we wanted to, if a Disney Channel movie was coming
right.
out or something,
yeah.
like we could.
That's a bunch of tickets right there.
A bunch of tickets, yeah. So spent more time actually being present with one another, actually, and reading and that kind of thing. And I also grew up spent a lot of time in church and spent mm-hmm. a lot of time also playing sports, which were all things that required presence and are also also rooted in ritual and ceremony and ensemble and
right.
and listening. And so I think that my formation around how I move through the world now as an adult or as a big kid is informed by that.
It's funny you say that. I had the realization not too long ago. I was involved in sports and not the arts when I was young. I didn't come to the arts until I was in my 20s. But I realized the urge was the same. So when I was involved in sports, it wasn't because I had some great skill and I needed to be on the football team to help that team win all the things. I was just like a mediocre person. I wanted to be on something. I wanted to be part of something. I wanted to be part of this ensemble of other people. And then when I got to the point in my life where this organized sport didn't exist anymore, I felt empty.
Hmm.
And that yearning to fill that emptiness eventually led me to theater. And my whole drive to be in theater is to be part of something, to be part of a group, part of an ensemble. Which is such a double-edged sword as a playwright, because you're on your own and you're writing this thing with the hopes that it can connect you into, it can log you into this sort of like ensemble, another group of people. And that's sort of like what keeps me grounded.
Yeah. So you played football.
Yeah, I was a football player.
Okay.
For like 5 or 6 years.
Okay, wow. What position did you play?
I was a defensive safety.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I played football as well.
I wasn't very good. I was a flanker, so like a wide receiver running back combo sort of player.
Yes.
And when I was young, when I was my first few years, so like junior high school into the early years of high school, I was always like a starter and I played and I did the things and I was okay. And then as I aged into, you know, the varsity team, I was no longer a starter. I was no longer that good, but I worked really, really hard, and I would get compliments for working so hard and in practice. So I would be like the scout team player in practice, and they started to call me scout, and it was nice to be recognized, but at the same time, it felt really insulting, you know?
Yeah.
And as I got older, I played less and less, And it was really sad. It was really sad because I was so enamored. I was named after football players. So it was as if it was my birthright to be a football player.
Hmm.
My first name is after Brian Piccolo, who was a famous Chicago Bears player who died of Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I also grew up thinking I was going to inherit that.
Wow.
Weirdly, because I was probably 12 when I found out about this movie called Brian's Song. About Brian Piccolo, this Bears running back who died of lymphoma. And then I come home and I tell my mom that I saw this movie at school. And my mother tells me I'm named after him.
Wow.
And I was like, what?
Wow.
And so I spent a good number of years thinking I'm going to get cancer because this person that was named, as if it transfers, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So you played football as well?
I did, yeah. Also wide receiver and played corner.
Yeah.
And special teams, was like a headhunter. And I feel, thinking about inheritance and legacy, so I come from a football family.
Yeah.
So my dad played professional football. He played in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
My dad played like 10 years of pro ball, and my brother, an uncle and cousins, like one of my cousins currently plays for the Saints.
Mm-hmm.
My cousins and my play for Clemson.
Yeah.
My brother played college football as well. And I was always, I played football, but I also ran track and did other things as well. So I felt the kind of pressure to live up to a kind of standard that actually wasn't my calling. I was fast, but I like really was not into like tackling, getting hit. You know, like I was like, you can miss me with all that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
So when I went to college, so I had an interest in gymnastics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually made this switch. So I played football in middle school. I played football in high school, and then in college I became a cheerleader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was this a cause of conflict in the family? Was there like a sense of duty, like you needed to go down this path?
I would say, looking back, no, I don't think it was a sense of duty. I think that there was a kind of, you know, and my father said, you don't have to play football. I think I always wanted him and wanted my parents to be proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like on some level, what accompanied my interest in camaraderie and being a part of a team, being a member of a team, and getting to suit up and enact the kind of ritual of that,
mm-hmm.
Was a kind of overcompensation for like shame around being queer,
mm-hmm.
and the ways in which femininity kind of manifests itself in my body and in my personality. So mm-hmm. I think I took that on maybe more than it was imposed upon me. I think they're hard to separate, but I felt like for me, it was a way to orbit around masculinity and kind of exist in that space that I thought might balance out or detract from negative feelings or a negative experience around queerness and being gay, which is something that I struggled with naming and really claiming at that time.
Where, how did you connect to the arts or theater?
Yeah, so growing up, my mother is wonderful. She and a close friend of hers, they had a storytelling troupe, actually. Sweet Pea and Aunt Ellie is how they were billed. And so they would put on these performances. They would still tell stories at, like in schools and at libraries and sometimes churches. And so, my mother, is a highly theatrical being.
Yeah.
And so I grew up around that. And my father is also, theatrical. And my father, I grew up watching and experiencing my father preach and speak in churches, and to teams, and I and because I was homeschooled, I had a lot of freedom and could travel with my dad when he was away for a speaking engagement. And so I feel like the kind of combination around like my father experiencing my father's monologues, and also the monologues of other preachers, and growing up in the church, and was always always interested in the kind of ritual of church. I loved the choir. I loved thinking about how preachers framed arguments, mm-hmm. And how they presented stories and interpreted texts. And so I think balancing like church with my mother's storytelling and poetry and how that kind of lived in our family. And also I grew up in choir and did like church productions and things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it was always kind of a part of my childhood and my life in that way. And so it was always kind of in me.
Did you feel of two parts? You know, here's this athlete part of you, here's this artist part of you.
I did. Yeah. I would say all the way up through college, really. I tried to be really intentional about keeping those lives very separate.
Yeah.
And have since done a lot of work around reconciling all those kind of parts of myself and recognizing that hyper compartmentalization really was an effort to keep myself safe.
Mm.
When, you know, now looking back, I can see that everything was always speaking to one another. And how they're not actually all that separate and all that different.
You talked about how you transitioned from being a football player to a cheerleader. How did that feel when you made that switch?
It felt great. It felt great. It was many things. I feel like on the one hand, I just was interested in taking off the pads, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed being in proximity into the ritual that was being enacted on the field.
Yeah.
Like I love the energy. I love, the kind of ceremony, the experience around it. But also I really loved tumbling. Like I loved flipping. I loved being able to challenge my body and still be physical, but in a way that felt more natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
I loved being able to, like I still had to train really hard and work really hard.
Yeah.
But I also felt like I could be myself around my teammates. It felt like a way that I could still be a part of a team and be in close proximity to this kind of this sport that was such a part of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it allowed me, looking back, actually maybe not even noticing in this moment, it allowed me to still feel close to my family and close to my father and close to family members for whom football and that whole thing was important, but allowed me to be able to express myself in a more full way.
Mm.
And just be and spend time with coaches and teammates, women, and also men who didn't judge me in the way that I felt judged or restrained on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, like I there were aspects of it I did miss, but I also feel like I was much more well suited to track and field anyway. I'm like, just let me run and not have to hit anyone.
Yeah. So when did you start to write, or consider yourself a writer?
I began to consider myself a writer in high school, and I'd always kept journals and diaries and things, but it was really, I guess, maybe my sophomore year in college. I was at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I was a member of this spoken word poetry collective called Ebony Readers Onyx Theater. And one of my cousins was a member of that group. And so I auditioned and was ushered into that space. And I found that I really enjoyed not only writing pieces for myself to perform,
mm-hmm.
and group pieces for myself and other people to perform, but I really enjoyed writing pieces that other people could perform. And you know, with spoken word, you know, it tends to be an art form that is very sharp and snappy, and something that folks can be really kind of emotionally reactive to. And sometimes that emotional reactivity does not hold space for substance, right? Mm-hmm. It can be like a soundbite or something that sounds good or resonates, but might ultimately be thinner than your experience of it in the moment.
Yeah.
But I love spoken word, and I do love, and I love, and I love, I think poetry is to be spoken aloud and shared. But I found that as like my pieces were not often the pieces that folks really responded to in the moment, right? So like I would observe other people write and perform, and you know, they get all the snaps, right?
Right.
And like I would perform a piece, right? Or after my pieces, there was always a sense of like, there was like a sense of contemplation. There was like a quiet. It wasn't the same kind of response. And so initially I experienced that as discouraging because I thought, like, I know this isn't bad, you know?
Right.
People are telling me it's good. People are responding to it, but the audience response isn't the response I'm seeing from other people, right? Or the response that other people are receiving.
Yeah.
And so as I delved further into my studies around both performance art and dramatic art, I had a foot in both of those departments, I realized that maybe my calling is not, like, maybe these are scenes, actually. Like, maybe these aren't quite, like, spoken word pieces, but maybe they are poetry with a dramatic engine beneath.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the sense of contemplation needs a different kind of dramatic container. And I had a professor who told me, you know, just pay attention to the things you make time for. And so I began to pay attention to the texts I was gravitating towards, the kind of theatrical experiences that excited me. And instead of trying to tailor my work to what the audience liked, I continued just to lean further into the direction of what was naturally inside of me.
Yeah.
And just let it be what it was, and slowly found my way to playwriting. And I think that was informed by both not having the opportunity to audition for plays that I, as a performer, for plays that I really felt like spoke to me in my experience, that I might have loved, but didn't feel like they were really illuminating aspects of what I felt like I could illuminate. And then also, actually, you know what? This is what's coming back to me. So for my senior honors thesis, I wanted to write a play.
And this is in undergrad?
This is in undergrad. So yes, I wrote my first play in college. And I just asked, can I write a play instead of a paper? And my advisors, you know, they were like, yeah, but you know, you're supposed to write a paper, like, yeah, like a research paper. And I thought, well, but can I write a play?
Yeah.
And the compromise was I can write a play and a small paper.
Okay.
And so I wrote a play, and that was my first experience, like really writing a play. And I had so much fun combining research and poetry and reading plays and all these things. And I thought, like, oh, if you can make a career out of this, this is what I want to do. And so it wasn't until like all of that kind of crystallized my senior year in college.
So what were you reading?
I was reading.
You were self-taught. You were just sort of like finding your way around what a play is and what it looks like and all of that.
That was true. I was finding my way around, but I also had some incredible teachers too. So I was I was studying in the Department of Dramatic Art.
Yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
I also was in the performance art department under communications.
Yeah.
And so I was reading and really inspired by the work of Intozaki Shange, August Wilson, Carol Churchill, at that time was reading Terrell Alvin McCraney, Sarah Rule, Lynn Nottage were some of the folks who really informed how I thought about play construction. And now, like, looking back, I feel like I have great respect for O'Neill, Miller, Shakespeare, when I think at the time, like, reading them, Ibsen, It like totally went over my head. I like totally was like I don't even really remember encountering those texts in college at that time, although I spent time with them.
Yeah.
I think that I needed to live more life in order to
understand. I have to agree because I think whenever Shakespeare came up, for me, it was more of just surviving that part of the class.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do I get through this? Because
yes.
This is not a language I speak. But then later in life, when I was in grad school and studying it, right? Like opening up that text, and then it started to make sense to me. And now I have an appreciation for it, but it's not accessible. Like it's not a good, I always have a problem with Shakespeare being the first dramatic pieces that students learn. It's just so inaccessible.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, like it really turned me off to it actually.
Yeah. 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 I wonder how many young people get turned off to theater simply because what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like, should I be called to teach? I'm excited to be able to do it in a way that really invites folks in.
Yeah.
And demystifies what we think we should know, how we are supposed to feel about something. I feel like we do ourselves a disservice by, I think, projecting a kind of reverence unnecessarily around. Not to say that work isn't great, but
right.
I feel like it creates a kind of distance to work that actually, I think, is more human than we allow it to be.
Yeah.
And
I
think for me too, when I think about, you know, O'Neill and Miller are great examples of this. I had a tough time divorcing subject and form in order to allow those things to come back together for myself. So I think that in this culturally reactive society and where identity politics are so combustible, like conversations around that are so combustible, I found that I think balance is important, but I found, and I speak to balance when I'm thinking about representation, like representation in curricula, representation in also what we're producing, what we're seeing on stages. But I found that I had so much to learn from playwrights who, when I was younger, I dismissed as a result of race, as a result of gender, as a result of the time in which they wrote, and thinking that, you know, times had changed so much, that how could this possibly be relevant to me and my experience?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's validity to that line of thinking, but I think that I also missed a lot of lessons. And now I'm able to return to text and think about the many ways in which I can experience a story. I can learn so much about structure. I can learn so much about something as small as timing and entrances and exits. And instead of necessarily feeling like I have to conform to those things, how can I actually invite other folks' experience of form and structure into my own experience of how I move through the world, which can deeply be informed by race and sexuality and place of origin and gender and all of those things. So I've learned to not dismiss anything.
That's good. When you were studying these texts to write this play your senior year, did you have professors that were pointing you to Sarah Rule and August Wilson and Lynn Nottage, or were you finding them on your own?
A combination.
Yeah.
Yeah, a combination. And we, before we began, or I guess at the beginning of our conversation, we spoke about Paula Vogel.
Mm-hmm.
And Paula Vogel was someone who was also introduced to me in college around that time. So I was both gravitating towards texts that I was curious about, but certainly had teachers who were instructive and... Yeah, and provided me with crumbs and roadmaps.
Yeah, I love teachers.
Teachers are the best.
It's the one consistent thing that has come out, conversation after conversation that I've done for this podcast, is the the crucial moment when the right teacher at the right time appeared to push the right button or point in a direction, and that causing this sort of like ripple effect in a playwright's life that so many playwrights can track back to a moment where if this teacher didn't happen in this time, they may not have become a writer.
Oh, for sure.
And that's kind of incredible to me. Like going into doing this, I never thought that that would be like the consistent through line.
Yeah. And it's so true. I mean, even as you say that, like certain faces and names are flashing in my mind. You know, I think about, Dr. Ashley Lucas, who's at the University of Michigan doing incredible work there, is one of my mentors and was so informative and encouraging for me at that time. Julie Fischel, an incredible actor and teacher. Joseph Meagle, all these folks come to mind. Patrick Johnson, who I never had the pleasure of meeting or have yet to meet, but just, and also the kind of the dominoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like teachers that I had a chance to meet and spend time with, and also teachers across time and space. Like for me, the poet Raina Maria Rilke. Rilke has been one of my teachers across time and space.
Yeah.
Daniel Alexander Jones. So I'm really grateful for teachers.
That's so great.
Yeah.
I like that you shout them all out.
Yeah.
Wish I should have a running scroll somewhere on social media to shout out all the teachers.
That'd be really cool.
That connect to all of the writers.
It'd be a cool web.
It would. It would. And I like to see where they all connect to each other. So you talked about when you wrote this play, you started to have the realization that this is your first play, and this is the thing that you wanted to do. I think what you're saying is, if I can make a life doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this is sort of like a decision point, it sounds like, right?
It was absolutely a decision point because I had only written, that was my first play. And I thought, okay, like this is what I'm going to do. I wasn't sure what the rest of my life was going to look like.
Right, yeah.
But I actually then used that play as a writing sample for grad school. And really only took 1 year off between undergrad and grad school, which some folks encouraged me to do and a lot of folks discouraged me from doing. And mm-hmm. I thought, I think I understand both sides of the argument.
Yeah.
And looking back, like if grad school was even in the cards for me, which I don't think everyone is called to grad school and I don't think it's necessary, but it was actually like my way to get out of North Carolina and to get to New York and begin to build a community there and just firmly be on a path for me.
Yeah. Why New York?
I always dreamt of going to New York. I was like that kid, always very little thought, like I see myself in New York. I see myself writing. I see myself performing. I see myself making art in New York without even knowing really what that meant.
Had you been to New York?
I had been to New York when I was little and didn't really have memory of it. And then I was actually there on a choir tour in high school. And those were really my only experiences of New York.
When you were in grad school, did you find yourself grounded in a place? Did you feel like comfortable? Like you, like a sense of belonging? Like you made the right choice?
No. Yes and no. Yes and no. It felt really good to be in New York, but I found grad school really challenging. Grad school was not, and challenging in not the ways I was excited about.
Yeah.
Looking back, and I'm still only a few years removed from that experience, and so I'm still processing and learning, and actually just over this recent holiday season, I unearthed all of my notebooks from grad school. So I was like going through and thought like, wow, I've repressed a lot of this experience.
Wow.
But it was cool to spend time with some of those lessons and some of my notes and some of even just the doodles I was making at that time. So I felt like, okay, it feels good to be in New York. I feel like I'm finding my people. I'm getting to see work. I'm inspired by what I'm seeing. I'm enjoying what it means to be here. But like my first semester in grad school, the entire first semester, I thought like I'm going to drop out, and almost dropped out after my first semester. At the end of my first year, I was pretty set on not going back for my second year. And so...
Was the conflict academic?
The conflict was multifaceted. But yeah, I just felt like the construction of the program and of my class just didn't suit my my needs and interests, and didn't wholly feel supported in what it was that I was trying to do. What I am grateful for, I'm grateful for some of the community I built, and I'm grateful that it allowed me, it really asked me then to, in turn, articulate my intentions, my desires, my needs. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to clearly see that, okay, if this isn't for me, right? If like all these people aren't my people, if this way of making work is not my way of making work, what is my way of making work? Who are my people? Where might the institutions exist or the communities exist that I really need to be able to really plant seeds and grow deep roots if it isn't here? So it was a pivotal time for me. And I might answer this question differently tomorrow.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But you went, you returned after year one.
I did. I did. I did. Yeah. I went back to North Carolina after my first year and really did pack a really big suitcase. I thought, I am not coming back. I ain't going to be back.
Yeah.
And after speaking with a couple of mentors and my parents, really thought, I kind of turned a corner and just thought, what's the lesson? Okay, what's the lesson? I'm here. I'm here. Yeah, what is the lesson? And I think that I spent my first year wanting to be received, wanting to be heard, wanting to be seen, feeling also the kind of responsibility or pressure to really impact like the community as it relates. So like, for example, so I was in my specific class, I was like one of two queer identified students and the only Black identified student of color. So just even based on my kind of interests or the kind of stories that I wanted to tell, that just really, there were a lot of restrictions and limitations within my class. So that was really frustrating. And so around conversations around inclusivity and diversity and difference and having the resources and space to support that, support some of the way I wanted to tell stories, I think I spent a lot of time engaging in those conversations actively, and that was really exhausting and draining and really detracted from my ability to really just focus on my work, just do my work.
Yeah, you constantly had to go to them.
I was educating.
And
yeah,
people needed to come to you.
Yeah, and I felt like you can't ever make anyone come to you. You can't force anyone to do anything or see anything they don't want to see. So I feel like the corner I turned between my first and second year was like, okay, this is transactional, and I'm here to get my education. So let me just focus on getting my education.
Yeah.
And so I stopped. I did withdraw a little bit from the community in terms of the kind of like the way in which I existed there my first year, being really involved in conversations and trying to fix things. I'm like, it's not my job to fix anything, actually. It's my job to do my work and to be here and to grow. And I can't straddle two horses in that way. And so I learned, I guess in a sense, just to focus a little bit and to be a little selfish. And at the same time that I was in grad school, 2014, 2015, 2016, there were also a lot of highly publicized instances around police brutality. And so that was also a really active component of my education that was really challenging, because a lot of folks in my class and in my institution didn't quite understand my experience of that moment in time. And so there were weeks where I would be out and engaging in the community and protesting and then come into class. And I was trying to balance all of that. And so I had to turn inward, and I'm glad that I did.
What was the impact on your work?
the impact.
Sort of all these outside influences, yeah. The good and the bad. How was it impacting your writing?
It was calling me to... I feel like it was the beginning of the erosion around compartmentalization and the ways that we spoke about earlier. Mm-hmm. I felt like if I'm going to be honest in my work and if I'm going to present myself unapologetically and if I'm going to heal, then I have to integrate all these things and recognize that they're not separate. So I feel like what all of that did was just break down all these barriers and these things that I wanted to keep separate. I couldn't anymore. What I was experiencing outside of the classroom bled into the classroom. What the institutional things I was experiencing affected the external. And at the same time, being removed from my family, realizing my life in North Carolina and my life in New York City, I might see them as separate, but they're reflections of one another. So I feel like the mirror started cracking and everything began to speak to one another in these ways that was really challenging because I could no longer keep out what was encroaching. Mm-hmm. And while that was a tough time, I'm grateful for it because it was forcing me to be free mm-hmm. and forcing me to be more truthful in ways that I hadn't been prior to that time. And so, yeah.
Did you ever have a moment where you felt like, I think I got this. I think this is I made the right choice. You know, is there a piece that you wrote or something that happened that triggered a thought like that?
Again, yes and no.
Yeah.
One specific experience does come to mind, and that was a collaboration with an incredible actor, well, more than actor, artist, Reggie D. White. Reggie is everything and mm-hmm. one of my dear friends, and I love, love, love Reggie. Mm-hmm. He's currently understudying The Inheritance on Broadway. And so Reggie is a magician. And this was, so I wrote something for Reggie. I really enjoy writing for people. I really mm-hmm. enjoy, yeah, getting to know folks and then writing pieces for them. That mm-hmm. feels like such that's a joy of mine. And this piece was directed by, and it was a one-man play. And directed by another dear friend and magician, conjurer, Stevie Walker Webb, who's just a beautiful director, activist, artist. Mm-hmm. And so it was the first time that I got to build a piece from the ground up with two other Black queer artists. And that was in my third year of grad school. So I wrote this piece that ended up being one of the winners in the Samuel French Off Broadway Festival. Mm-hmm. And that was like a moment where I was like, oh, wait, doing this in an aligned way, like doing this with artists who get me, you know, who understand me, we can like make magic together. So I'm like, oh, if I really just find my people and do things in the way that I know I want to do it, like really cool things can happen.
Yeah.
And that was encouraging. But at the same time, I feel like it was a glimpse, but I don't know that I still felt like, oh, I'm in the right place, because so much of what I was seeing championed and so much of what I was seeing programmed was so just not me and not the thing I was doing mm-hmm. and not the thing I was interested in. So I thought, huh, this is going to be really interesting
mm-hmm.
holding space for both, knowing deep in my heart that I'm supposed to be doing this and I'm supposed to be here, but the industry or the environment not necessarily being receptive or open to me or to the thing that I do or what I can bring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you do after that? So you finished school shortly thereafter.
I did.
And you got a glimpse of what it all can be, right?
Yeah.
Was this something you just started to chase after?
I also do want to shout out Christopher Shin. Mm-hmm. Chris was and has continued to be an incredible support system and guide. Mm-hmm. And so the encouragement that I received from Chris and some other folks was like, keep going, mm-hmm. you know, just keep going. And I had the support from some people just to just to continue to try and to write. And I was definitely that person initially who was like, okay, well, let me apply to these residencies and do all these things just so that, like, I was really allergic to the idea of having a day job.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought, like, I've made some really tough sacrifices and taken a lot of risks, things that a lot of my friends are like, you're crazy, in order just to continue to try and to make my way. And so after grad school, and also a supportive partner who really was like, yeah, this is wild, but, you know, pursue your dreams.
Yeah, we got you.
Yeah, yeah. So initially after grad school, I participated in some residencies and some things, and just continued to write. And it wasn't easy. Like, on a month-to-month basis, I really didn't know, where the next paycheck was coming from.
Yeah.
So I had to get really creative, which is a different conversation. And then it was 2019, actually, that I got my first TV job. So that wasn't too long after.
How did you connect to representation after grad school?
Yeah.
Because usually it's the representation that will then hook you up with the potential, you know, TV job, right?
Yes. So the agency that I signed with initially, because I'm now with a different agency, I was introduced to that agent in grad school, actually. Mm-hmm. So as a part of my third year in grad school, we did have a thesis kind of festival.
Mm-hmm.
And normally there are four playwrights in a class. And by the time we finished, there were only two writers in our class.
Mm-hmm.
So we petitioned to write two theses, which was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two opportunities to share different works. And so folks did come to those presentations.
Mm-hmm.
And also the school, you know, tried to connect us to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of those moments of alignment where I was grateful enough to have made enough friends or to have met enough people to say, like, hey, you should, like, think about this person. Like, have you read this person's work? And so I've received a tremendous amount of support and help from folks who just kind of pointed me in the direction of, that person.
Was TV aspirational for you, or was it... you know, a good paycheck so you could pay rent for a while? Or was it, you know, a social experiment? Like, what was TV writing for you? Or what is it? I'm not sure where you are with it at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I know how to answer that question. But in this moment, TV... Well, at the time, TV was a big question mark. It was a curiosity. It was something I was interested in. I think it was also something that I was told I was supposed to want.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like in reaching that goal, and I even put that in quotation marks, right? Like, it means something. And I think what I learned was that I'm certainly interested in TV and interested in film as media, as vehicles for storytelling, but that the tools required to do them are very different.
Mm.
And so I think that also dovetails into our earlier conversation around perception, the lived experience of something and the reflection of something, or the projection of something, rather. So I'm grateful for the lessons I learned in TV and would certainly do it again. But under very specific circumstances. And I think I know what conversations to have now.
Did you feel that sense of being part of something when you were in a writer's room? Like we talked about before, about being on a football team or being, you know, working on a play. Did you feel that on TV?
Yeah, I did feel that. I did feel that on TV. And in fact, especially in the first room I was in, like I made like friends that are going to be friends for life.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a conversation with Lauren Yee?
Not yet.
Okay.
No. She's on my wish list.
Okay. Yeah. Lauren is one of the playwrights I was in the room with, and I have so much love for Lauren, and had not met Lauren prior to working on the show together. Yeah. So those kinds of relationships I am eternally grateful for.
Yeah.
But I think at the same time, what was different is that, like, around, like, sports I'd played and theater, because it's not about money, and because money and, I mean, power is very much still a dynamic, but because, like, resources and money is different, comfortability is different, a sense of security, even, like, falsely, is different, I didn't quite feel the same sense of we're in this together because our hearts are in it, always, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, resources, money, and power really can change something.
Yeah, can't they?
They can.
Are you after anything at the moment?
That's a good question. I am, if anything, well, I have a lot of, a lot of things, but I feel like the umbrella that goes over that whole question is autonomy.
Yeah.
And by that, I'm really interested in constructing stories and curating emotional experiences that don't fit neatly inside of what a lot of people do. And so I'm interested in having the kind of support or access to resources that'll allow me to be free so that I can attempt some things that I don't think we've seen yet. Yeah.
I see you running something.
I'm into that.
I don't know what that is, but I see it. Just flashed into my head the way you just framed that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I received that. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Do you aspire to perform anymore? Do you think about that at all?
I do, and I'm returning to performing, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't perform for a while. And in grad school, I didn't perform very much. Sometimes I would perform my own work on a couple of occasions, but I'm learning how to speak again. I'm learning how to sing again. I'm also learning to play the guitar. Yeah, and those were all things that were such a big part of my childhood. And I think as a result of being told I couldn't do things or insecurities or unresolved or unhealed things within me, I really shied away from it. And I think also one unfortunate aspect of, for me, grad school in New York was that, was the pigeonholing and being told, like, this is the path you're on, so this is what you are. Like, you can just be a playwright. This is the path. This is the trajectory you must follow. And so part of what was so delicious about LA was getting to, at a very critical moment in time, leave New York before I felt like really solidified in that kind of container to be able to break out of that and remind myself and be reminded that I contain multitudes and that those things that I really loved as a child and the things that made me really come alive, they're still in there. And so to answer your question, yeah, I'm excited to lean into performing.
Where do you feel at home?
This may not be the answer. I don't know if you were looking for a specific answer, but when you asked it, the first response is in my body. I really feel at home in my body in a way that I've never felt at home. And I think part of that has to do with all of the, like, the travel and the juggling and allowing the plates to fall and crash, like recognizing that for such a long period of time, I was unable to locate home or in a specific place, a specific geographic location, and also in a specific community. So I think I was forced to no longer abandon this shell, this container that I move around in and have to locate home in here. And I think part of that has to do with the kind of unfolding, the kind of rediscovery of who I've always been and allowing those things to speak to one another.
Yeah.
And I hope soon, though, I would like to be able to plant roots somewhere and locate home in a kind of specific place.
Yeah.
But for now, I'm happy to have home be here.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're at home in your body, you're home wherever you are.
I'm home everywhere.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this. It was really good talking to you.
Thank you for asking. Likewise. Yeah, it's been a joy to speak with you and sit with you.
Yeah. Thanks, Cord, and thank you, Goodman Theater. I interviewed Cord in the same spot as my interview with Paula Vogel about a year and a half ago. I think there's some good mojo in that space, and I should ask the Goodman if they'll let me interview everybody there. I don't know. I'll ask. Cord's play, Graveyard Shift, is playing now in Chicago. It runs through March 8th. Get there if you can to see it. Tickets and info and all that can be found at goodmantheater.org. Music from this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions. The theme song is High by International Pen Pal. The subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and is produced, edited, and hosted by me. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is Underdogs by Spencer Davis. It's such a great ensemble piece about family, politics, gentrification. It's funny, it's moving, it's just awesome. I think I saw the very first reading of this play, so keep your eyes open for what is very likely going to be the next great Chicago play.